Hello, my name's Seth Townsley, and I'm passionate about energy reduction, climate change, and new technology that assists organisations and communities reduce the carbon footprint. I also happen to be the Energy Marketing Manager at Schneider Electric, the world's most sustainable business. So it's great to work for an organisation that practices what it preaches and enables you to indulge yourself in your hobby. Climate change is already being felt across the world. We're seeing polar vortexes in Texas, mass flooding across Europe, the subcontinent of the Far East, bushfires in Australia and the USA, and record temperatures globally. Reducing global emissions faster will hold warming to lower levels. Every degree matters. So in this very special episode of our Drive to Net Zero, we are honoured to invite Lord Deben to discuss COP26 and the drive to a greener, cleaner and more sustainable world. Lord Deben is chairman of the UK's Independent Committee on Climate Change. He also chairs the sustainability consultancy Sancroft International and recycler Valpak. He is a trustee of climate change charity Cool Earth alongside the ocean conservation charity Blue Marine Foundation. As Environment Secretary, he introduced the Environment Act in 1995 and the Landfill Tax, which was the first such environment tax in the UK. During this time, he also pursued environmental causes, including an early day motion on global warming to Parliament. He was also instrumental in the passing of the Climate Change Act in 2008. The BBC Wildlife magazine described Lord Deben as the Environment Secretary against which all others are judged. In 1997, he was awarded the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds Medal and was described by Friends of the Earth as the best Environment Secretary we've ever had. Good morning, Lord Deben. It's wonderful to have you join me on the call today. Since the days of Edward Heath's government, could you tell me a little bit about your career in sustainability and the environment and what drew you to the industry?
Oh, well, I think you have to go back before that, because I was, as a small boy, I mean, the thing that I learnt from my father very strongly was that we were all stewards, that we didn't in that sense own anything. It was had all been given to us. And so one had to recognise that we were supposed to be looking after what we had inherited. So in every way that he lived and every way he worked and talked, it was about that. And so I think I started there. And then later on, the biggest change, I suppose, was reading Rachel Carson's The Silent Spring. And because my roots are in the countryside, obviously that had a huge effect on one's attitude. So I suppose I entered politics really with that very strong feeling about our role in creation. So you can't avoid it, and it's therefore very central. So right the way through, right from the beginning, when I worked my first sort of job was the private secretary, parliamentary private secretary to the Minister of Agriculture. So in the Ted Heath government. So that was the beginnings of understanding how these things had to be applied to agriculture. So then when later on I became, in fact, deputy minister and then Minister of Agriculture, and therefore spent 7 years in the Ministry of Agriculture one way and another. I began the big change from agriculture based entirely on food production to agriculture which recognised the needs of the soil, of the environment, of nature, all those things. And so that's really then I got sent to be a Secretary of State for the Environment. So it was a story which was very fortunate.
Yeah, so I guess probably in a very fortunate position where you kind of, it was probably an innate thing. It was a sense through the family that you were brought up with and things. Do you ever feel like a sense of frustration in the pace in which everyone else has adopted it versus yourself? Clearly you were very pioneering with your thinking and bringing it onto the political platform. Do you ever feel there was a sense there that it was that people weren't embracing or adopting your thinking quickly enough? Because certainly we're in a different place now.
Oh, well, it's if you have a strong view about anything, it's you always worry why other people don't sort of catch on to it quite as quickly as you'd like them to. But I am amazed actually at the speed with which it has all changed. I mean, I thought 5 years ago at the Paris Agreement, if we had said even 2 years before that the whole world would sign up to a position on climate change, every single country, we'd have been laughed at. And I just think that one does have to recognise just how much we've managed in the meantime.
Yeah, absolutely. As you said, embracing kind of the new, the changes and the fact that we are evolving into a blessed world. It is one of the generational pieces, isn't it? The fact that we were the first generation, we talk about me and you collectively, that recognised there was a climate challenge, and the fact that we're the first generation to be able to genuinely do something about it. We can change things collectively.
Yeah, I mean, there were apostles beforehand. I mean, we mustn't forget some of those people. I mean, the founders of the Soil Association, for example, who, if you cast aside some of the loonier bits, the fact was that they managed to and I was very affected by them, because it happened to be true that when I became a candidate for the I constituency, the first organic farm had been certified in that constituency. So when I was doing my homework back in 1975, I found out about this. And of course, the great thing that the Soil Association has done, and the activities of organic farming, was to remind people of the importance of the soil and our need to respect the soil. And it does seem to me that the part of the whole concept of stewardship is respect. Respect for soil, respect for animals, respect actually for the remarkable way in which the world works. I mean, it always seems to me to be such an amazing fact that things fit in. So when we now see spring happening 17 days earlier than it did when I first came here, which is 40 years ago. So in 40 years, terribly short time in millennia.
Yeah.
The spring comes 17 days earlier, and therefore the blossom comes out before the pollinators, and the thing gets out of kilter. There are two lessons to that. One is it's very dangerous, but the other is how wonderful that things are in kilter, if you see what I mean. And so I do recognise that one of the things that we have to do, and this is why I'm an optimist, and I want not to depress people. One of the ones we have to do is to recognise again just the sheer beauty and remarkable nature of the created world.
Absolutely. Wonderful thoughts. I'm going to flip over now to the kind of the world, the other side of the coin is around power and industry. And I guess probably over the course of the last 5 years, there's been more change in the electricity network in the past 5 years than in the previous 100. You know, the pace of technology and digitization has increased exponentially with a smarter and more connected grid, and it needs us to, and it's, you know, accelerating really in terms of technology. You know, energy consumption is also increasing. So I guess probably my first question, in the lead up to COP26, are there any countries you believe are leading this green industrial revolution around decarbonizing their nations? Is, you know, the UK and Ireland, is it in a status? Is it high on the, you know, is it an early adopter, or are there other countries that we can take knowledge and understanding of best practice from?
Well, I'm deeply opposed to British exceptionalism, so I'm rather careful about saying that we are too much in the head. We are, in fact, a leader in this, and we're a leader in it for the reasons that people don't normally recognise. I mean, the first is that it is an all-party thing. We are not divided politically on the needs to make the changes, and that's hugely important. Secondly, we're a leader because we are actually willing to accept technological change in a way which some countries are not. And I think thirdly, we are a leader because we have recognised a kind of responsibility which perhaps other countries don't recognise or don't have. I mean, after all, we created the Industrial Revolution. We've caused much of the climate change, as a matter of fact, that affects us now. We have also profited from it. And the pollution which we've caused has made us rich. And there's that feeling in the background. So the fact that we have done, and therefore we done the biggest thing of all, which was to institutionalize the means of change, so that the Climate Change Act, the Climate Change Committee, the independence of it, the fact that we set targets which become statutory and which are then not able to be changed, these are quite different from anyone else. And we've really led the world in that. And it keeps our feet to the fire. So without being in any way complacent, because my goodness, there are some things this government's done and other governments have done that they oughtn't to have done, and all kinds of things we've got to change. The fact is, we, I think, can say that we are in the van of this whole process. But the European Union, which we influence, and the terrible sadness of leaving the European Union, which is really one of the most dreadful things that a government has ever done, a nation has ever done, simply because it means that you remove yourself from being able to influence. We should be there influencing these decisions and be part of a great grouping. And it's morally wrong to remove yourself from an opportunity, as we have done. So very sad.
Yeah.
But the fact is, we've influenced the rest of Europe and we will go on influencing it. And we are fortunate enough to have these two opportunities this year at the G7 because of our presidency of that. And of course, of COP26, which is the crucial moment in which we ratchet up the acceptance of real responsibility throughout the world.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Lord Eben. So in government policy, aside from Brexit, do you feel it's in the right place now? And where do we need to have clearer, stronger decisions to improve?
Well, it's policies in the right place. And I really, I have to say, I'm very impressed with the fact that the government is committed in a way which you might not have expected. And the Prime Minister's 10 points are the right 10 points. The Chancellor's budget, for example, didn't meet some people's expectations. But my goodness, the things he did do took us way beyond what people might have thought. I mean, to rewrite Britain's economic policy and insist that in future the Bank of England take net zero climate change at the centre of its decision making is a fundamental change which no other country has made. Green bonds and green savings and a whole series of things on the financial side are really important. And I think that the Chancellor is right to recognise that it is changes on finance which will make the difference. And if you think of the investment that you have been talking about in terms of the grid, in terms of new technology, what is hugely necessary is that the whole might of finance is actually behind that, because the issue is not invention, the issue is commercialization. And therefore, finance is crucial to that. So the government is, all that is right. But the thing that's wrong is that we are not urgent enough in the implementations of the details of the policy. So if you take a very good piece of policy, no cars except electric and equivalent cars to be sold after 2030, that's absolutely first rate. But we still haven't got the detailed steps by which we say by 2025, X proportion of those sold, 2028, Y proportion, so that when you get to the 2030, you've actually done those things. We still haven't had a detailed program forecasting the rollout of this very important thing, the charging structures. We still haven't had the housing policy, the future homes policy, which means that every new house would be fitted with the ability to charge conveniently your motor car. We haven't had the standards in the housing, which means that we are building houses that don't have to be retrofitted because of their energy efficiency. There are a million homes that have to be retrofitted, that have been built in the last few years, which the government allowed to be built in a crap way. I mean, what they've done is not to be energy efficient enough. The owners are going to have to spend money on making them energy efficient and the house builders have run away with the profit. I just think it's outrageous. So there are a whole range of things of that kind, detailed kind, which we really have to get, and which is my job as chairman of the Climate Change Committee, is to keep the government's feet to the fire.
So looking at the power grid piece, do you believe that the grid is ready for a future of decentralized energy generation now? I guess probably from a grid and maybe from a prosumer point of view?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that there's, again, quite a lot of goodwill and quite a lot of stuff has been done. I think there are four things which really haven't worked so far. First of all, the point you make about consumers, the relationship between the consumer and electricity is extremely bad. First of all, and the grid suffers from this, National Grid suffers from it. So do the transmission companies. They suffer from it because the power providers, the big utilities, have the worst public relations and the worst customer relations of any organization I know. I once scandalized by people saying that my wife, Lady Deben, is hates Npower. Now, Npower has been bought, as you know, but hates Npower more than any other company in the world. And the reason is that they wasted so much of her time because they don't answer the telephone. And the biggest difference happens when you move to somebody who does answer the telephone, and you then have a different view. It's not just a question of getting green electricity; it's getting proper customer relations. Now, I know it's partly because they are ex-nationalized industries; they have no tradition of having to earn their money, so to speak. But the fact is, it's a long time since privatization. They still don't. So that I think this is a really serious issue, is that until the electricity industry has a relationship with its customers, which are, I mean, after all, it only has to be as good as the water industry. I mean, the water industry does, the water industry answers the telephone. The water industry actually does give the impression that they want to help you. And this is a real break. So the first thing is getting that right. The second thing, because the customer needs to feel confident in the people that it deals with, and it doesn't know about the National Grid. Why should it bother about National Grid? Why should it know about UK networks? This has nothing to do with it. What is to do with it is the company who sends it the bills. And so that's the area we've got to get right. Secondly, we haven't managed to explain smart metering and the whole mechanism that there is today, and why that's in people's interests. We really haven't, and it's still thought of as a kind of spy in the cab kind of thing. It's still thought of as in a way, the company interfering. And that's partly because of the first thing, because they don't trust the companies, because the companies don't talk to them, because the companies have no idea of customer relationships. Then you then get onto the situation that therefore there's no communication about these new installations. And the third thing we've got to get right is just change. We haven't really come to terms with the fact that as you move from electricity, as you move to electricity, there are real issues of cost for many people. And although the cost of overall cost of getting to net zero is less than 1% of the GNP, and although most of that will be paid by the private sector, the truth is that the distribution of that cost is much more unequal. We've made it worse because in the fantastic move towards offshore wind, we paid for it by putting the price on the electricity bill. Now, for the 80% who have both electricity and gas, that's perfectly all right. But for the 20% who don't have any gas, they've been paying a much more intensive proportion of the cost, $6.7 billion. And they very often are poorer people and people living in the countryside. And we really can't go forward on a system where that sort of injustice is seen to operate. And that's why on the electricity side, nothing to do with the companies, except that what the government should do is to move the costs from electricity to gas, because gas ought to be becoming more expensive and electricity ought to be becoming cheaper, because you want people to switch to electricity. And so that part of it, and if you want to get that right, so then I come to the last thing, which is the grid itself. I do think that there is a real worry about the grid. I mean, I think, first of all, the position of National Grid is questionable. I think that the bits that it does, there is a perceived problem of conflict of interest, and I think we have got to approach that, and that is a serious issue. But leaving that aside, I do think we need to recognise that the readiness of the grid for this entire change is questionable. I don't think we're there yet. I think there's a lot that still has to be done. And some of those things are very obvious. For example, what the hell are we doing still connecting each offshore wind with the grid, with its own special connection, with all the problems that that means, instead of having a proper proper system round the coast, which it all feeds into and doesn't despoil the countryside in villages right the way round, which is a balmy thing to do. And it's quite the wrong way to do it. That's because our competition laws were written at a time which we hadn't think about that. So we haven't actually organised that. There are things of that sort that we've got to get right, as well as understanding just how enormous, it's your point really, the enormous revolution moving from a centralized generation system to a very, very much more distributed one. I always like the fact that the French call a generator a centrale, because it just reminds you of how the system used to work. A small number of large lumps of generating capacity, shoving it out. And we now have a wholly different system. And of course, you're trying to move the old system into the new. And I do recognise National Grid's fundamental problems, and the associated with the distribution companies of turning this into something different. We're not there yet. We're still charging people too much for the connections that we're talking about. We've got old-fashioned structures in the way in which we pay for things. There's a huge amount to be done, and I'm not sure we're moving fast enough.
So just my final question around the power and industry piece is around, so what are your thoughts around the adoption of renewable energy generation and storage? Is it as you'd expect it to be, or do you feel we can accelerate deployment, we can move quicker with it?
Well, I think it's what I expected, and it's rather better than I expected, actually. There was a time which I was more depressed about it, but it's better than I expected. I still think that there's a problem of connection of a different sort. I was talking to the chairman of the Greater Cambridge Group, which is working on the issues of climate change. And they point out that the local distribution company isn't given any access to the plans for people to develop. So the development on the local authorities aren't linked together with UK, in this case it's the UK group. So suddenly they discover that planning permission has been given for something or other, which they're supposed to connect to, if you see what I mean. We don't have a joined up system in that sense. And that's one of the things I think would make a huge difference, if we enable the energy companies to know more about it, to be involved in it much more as far as development is concerned, particularly as we develop our way out of COVID and develop our way into a low carbon economy.
Oh, lovely. Thank you for that. Really, 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 yeah, really interesting answers. Really, some really good insight in there. The next topic I'd like to talk around is decarbonizing transport. It's a very exciting time in the e-mobility world currently. You know, more and more automotive manufacturers are now embracing this movement, with the giants like VW Group and Daimler following the likes of Tesla and Nissan with their own all-electric versions. But the transport sector is still a huge source of emissions. With EVs on the road now totaling about just over 400,000 versus a 38 million internal combustion engine vehicle critical mass, what do you think? Why do you think progress has been relatively slow in this EV adoption?
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you. I was always very worried about the motor car because, I mean, I'm fairly atypical in this because I'm not a petrol head at all. And I'm not very interested in my motor car. I'm interested in having one, but I'm not very interested in it, if you see what I mean. It doesn't fill me with great sexual joy, which, of course, appears to do for very large numbers of people. But the fact of the matter is that I thought it would be very difficult to move to electric cars because people have this view of them, which is that there's something lighter and less exciting, less masculine about it. I mean, and that's why Tesla is so vital. I mean, what Tesla did, the e-races, those two things together, began an attitude which showed that you could actually embrace electricity and still be a real man, being very keen on the motor car. And so I think we've moved much faster than I thought we were going to, and I think we are moving much faster. And the government's in this country, the government's decision to tell people that after this date they're not going to be able to buy any car except an electric car or its equivalent is crucial, because it means that the economics get into line then. So anybody who's buying a fleet is going to say, well, I'm not going to buy a fleet of cars which I can't sell properly, because that's obviously going to happen. So I will move quickly. Motor car industry itself has speeded up as a result of this. So since the government fixed that, and in concert with a number of other countries doing this, the motor car industry has moved very much faster. So you've now find Ford, which was behind, now in the front by saying it's not going to produce cars except electric cars in Europe after a date which is before 2030. So the whole thing has speeded up. And if you look in your newspapers, if you see the difference between the motoring columns today from what they were even 2 years ago, they're all concentrating on now which of the cars that will give you the range, which are the cars that provide you with all the other things that you want. All that is happening. So I think we're going to meet that side of it. The much more important and difficult thing. Oh, the other thing is that vans are included in that. That's a really important thing. The difficult thing, I think, is how we make the transfer as far as heavy goods vehicles are concerned, and the whole issue of hydrogen and how we do this, because we don't know how to do it in a green way, because we can do it with hydrogen, but of course we can't make hydrogen in a cost-effective and green manner at the moment. So there's a great deal to be done in that area. And we've also got to be much tougher about the regulation on a whole range of things. I mean, we've got to take seriously the fact that if we're not careful, we're going to create a new cost because of our growing dependence on mail order, which COVID has speeded up. Pandemics don't change things, they speed things up. That's what happened. So delivery, that last mile delivery issue, the standards and quality of the vehicles that do that, the cost of it. I am a believer very much in a shift in taxation so that the business rates are reduced significantly on retail, which in general is environmentally more friendly than delivery, certainly next day or this day delivery. I mean, we are beginning to promise things which really aren't sensible. It isn't sensible to say to people, whether you need it or not, we will deliver it. I mean, I bought something from recently, which was a bit of a gizmo to fit in as far as the internet was concerned. And I ordered it from a, as they say, a well-known high street retailer. I ordered it at 5 o'clock one evening. I'm 12 miles from the nearest town here. And it was on my doorstep before 8 o'clock the next morning. That's balmy. I mean, just a balmy cost. And it's a balmy cost to the environment, because we need to have a system whereby it benefits the purchaser if he fits into a green travel plan, so that should have been delivered to me over a period of 2 or 3 days when it fitted in with the run of that particular company. I'm quite sure there wasn't anybody else buying from that company in my village that time. So that was a special visit out 12 miles from the nearest town. So we've got to do a lot of change in that way to make what we have got more sensible. And then in the other way is the investment in research to deliver an HGV and other sorts of vehicles. I had a long conversation with Lord Bamford, running the JCB company, about how they are trying to develop in the hydrogen area, because they see that as having to be the future of JCB trucks and lifts and all the rest of it. The difficulty for us is, how do you provide the source of that, the energy from that, in a sensible way?
Thank you for that. How do you, you've touched on it there a little bit, Niggs, but just want to kind of just do a bit more of a deep dive in there. How do you think transport will evolve over the course of the next 10 years? You know, people talk about air mobility or compact mobility. So people, you know, smaller cars, bikes, electric scooters, or automated driving. Do you see there's going to be a change at all? A slight one, or a drastic change in the way that people move around?
I don't think people will want to have any less connectivity. I don't think. So I think what will happen is that the change will be from an issue of energy use as we move to renewable electricity. The biggest issue is then going to be about congestion, as a matter of fact, because the change of energy doesn't make a difference in the congestion. So I think we're going to have a real issue there. Smaller cars, I think there'll be a lot more e-bikes. Delivery will be done much more by e-bikes. And if we change the law so that we can have electric hand-driven trucks, which you're not allowed to have on the road at the moment, but there's no reason why we shouldn't have that, so that somebody walks with them, because local deliveries can be very sensibly done. At the moment, they have to do all the testing in Dublin, because the law isn't the same in the Republic of Ireland as it is in the north of Ireland, or indeed anywhere else in the United Kingdom. So there are a little changes that need to be done, but there'll be much more of that. As far as smaller vehicles, sort of pod-like vehicles, I think that the problem with that is it's a matter of people's perception of safety. And that's really why people have gone for SUVs so much. And that is a very bad direction to go in. Indeed, I'm very much an advocate for taxing SUVs much more heavily than other things, because we've wasted all the advantage that we've had of improvement in the internal combustion engine by merely moving up from smaller cars to bigger cars. So that really has not been a sensible situation at all. But it seems to me that there is a position in which some type of AV, ultimately it will be complete, but we know that AV can make driving safer, very, very much safer. So the sort of assisted driving with AV will, I think, make it possible for people to be much more willing to have a smaller car, feeling it safer, because the whole of driving will be safer. I think that will be a very helpful part of it. I don't think that when people have got an appetite, it is easy to change that appetite. So we do now want to go and see people. And COVID has taught us that, hasn't it? I mean, what is it that we've really missed? What we've really missed is the fact that I can drive my car across to my neighbours. I can walk to my neighbours, but I can't see them. Now, the point is, it's the thing we've noticed we've missed most, actually. It's the mixture that and I sit in my house and think to myself, well, 100 years ago, the way I live today in lockdown is exactly the way that the person who lived in this house then lived, because the connectivity wasn't there. So he did exactly what I do, which is to walk into the village or drive his coach or a trap down into the village, which is a mile away, and do his shopping in the village, just as I do my shopping in the village. Now I've had my injections, and come back again. But I don't see anybody. I don't meet anybody except in the street, so to speak. And then we are socially distanced and got a mask on. The reality is that I'm living very much like people did live 100 years ago. The reality is we don't like it, and that's not what we've got used to. So we're not going to change that. I don't think we'll change that. What we've got to do is to take this opportunity of making connectivity both not cost the earth, which is decarbonizing it, but also making it more comfortable by making it quieter. That is helped hugely by electricity. By making it cleaner, that means we've got to do a lot more work on what tires do to the road and the emissions from that, because those are also important emissions for our health. And we're also going to have, I think, to try to have smaller individual vehicles in which AV will give us the safety we need.
Okay. So the final question around e-mobility is around, you know, fuel tax on internal combustion engine cars has been a valuable source of income for the government. How do you feel they will recoup this revenue as the mass market migrates to electric vehicles?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that some form of pricing on the number of miles you drive is the only way to do it. I mean, I can't think of a different way. And I was thinking, because we having a lot of meetings with the Americans at the moment, as you can imagine, and most of the problems are similar, but our biggest problem they don't have, because they don't tax fuel anything like as much as we do. They don't have the same problem. But I never understood really why people feel so strongly about a mileage system. I mean, it is true that if you live in the countryside, people feel that it's unfair, given that if you live in the town, you don't travel so much, don't have to travel so much. But I'm afraid it's one of the, although I'm very keen on the just transition, it still seems to me that in the end, you have to have a system whereby you pay per mile. And now, of course, we've got all the technology to be able to do that terribly simply. And you do it rather like you do the congestion charge. I mean, you have when we cross, as we do have to quite a bit, we cross the Dartford Bridge, that's now all done automatically. You pay into in advance, and they take it off your pay in advance. Well, I'm not suggesting we pay in advance in this sense, but there's no reason why all this could not be entirely automatic. And you have some sort of mechanism of paying it in that way. And so just as you pay every time you fill up with the present energy tax, you would pay automatically every month as you traveled, or whatever it was that you decided to do. And you could choose to pay in advance or pay in retrospect, whichever you wanted. And there's no reason why that shouldn't happen. At the same time, you certainly continue to tax internal combustion to some extent, because you want to make the difference in the cost.
That's probably the clearest answer I've had so far on that as well. Yeah, crikey, that's superb. Thank you. My final topic today is to talk around building net zero homes. You know, residential heating will account for, I think we've calculated 100 terawatt hours of power, but in 2050 versus today, and the demand will be stronger, so homes will have to be smarter and more connected to the network to manage things like bi-directional power flow, especially when residents start to generate their own energy and maybe use their electric vehicle as a mobile source of battery storage. How do you think house builders and developers have generally embraced the concept of smart homes and buildings, Lord Deben?
Well, I think the house building industry has been incredibly bad, let's just say. I mean, I have a very serious criticism of the fact that there are 9 house builders who build something like 80% of the new homes in Britain. They have done absolutely nothing except do what the government tells them to do. So they haven't developed as they could have done cleaner, more energy efficient homes. They've just waited for the government to propose higher standards. They then complained about the higher standards. And as you know, they were effective in stopping the zero carbon homes, which was scheduled for 2017, which the Conservative government at the time stopped, which was really very bad indeed. And that's why I say there are 1 million homes in which the house builders have actually put the cost of energy efficiency from themselves to the purchaser. I mean, a transfer of cost, which is entirely unacceptable. And of course, the truth is that you can make an energy efficient home at the same price as an energy inefficient home for 3 reasons. One is, if all homes are built that way, then the bits and pieces you need to do it are, of course, mass produced instead of being a niche business as they are to some extent at the moment. The second reason is that the price of homes in this country is not a question of adding up the costs. What happens with the price of homes is the house builder decides how much he can sell the house for. And then he says, how much does it cost me to build it? And how much do I get as profit? And then he offers for the land the cost he thinks he's got left over, so to speak. So it's the land price would take all the extra cost, because if it's costing him more to build the house, what he'd really do would be to lower the land price. And because the land price for development is so much higher than the land price for agriculture, people are going to just have to accept that they won't get the huge amount, they'll get almost the huge amount, and that difference will be the cost of turning out energy efficient homes. And the only reason why that hasn't happened is because most of these developers are now actually in the business of land, actually speculation, and they bought the land already, and they don't want to have to, in effect, reduce the value that they get out of the land that they bought. So I think the government's got to be very tough with the industry and make it absolutely clear they're not having this anymore, and they really are going to meet new standards, and that has to be done. So that gets you, at least stops you making it worse. Then as far as your average punter, so to speak, in the home that they bought, the present government has been successful, and people forget this, in the work that it's been doing with local authorities and with supported housing, and that has been improving considerably, and it can go on doing that, and it's putting a lot of money into it. Very good for jobs, because this is an area where you can spread jobs all around the country. It's extremely good. It's been an absolute abject failure when it's come to try to help ordinary people who own their own house make the changes. And the Green Deal was a disastrous failure. And it's now quite clear that that part of the present program isn't working, and they can't get people to take it up. And I think the government's got to say to itself, well, we can't get people to take it up. We can't blame them. We must have the wrong mix. So we've got to think about that. And I do believe that there is a perfectly good mix to it. And I'm fairly revolutionary in this. I mean, I know what I would do. I would bring in three or four of the major companies that have shown themselves very effective in delivery themselves. Tesco's, B&Q. I mean, you can go through a whole series of people who really know about these things and say to them, we want to have a system and we want to do it through you. And you will deliver it. So when I go to buy do-it-yourself stuff, or whether I go into Tesco's, I can buy this, and they will deliver and sort it, and therefore I feel confident in it, and I know that their list of accredited deliverers will work. And I think there's a great deal to be said for using the effective systems of the private sector, backed up by government support, which I think will then mean that people will make these choices. And also, we will build an accredited system. Because I think the real problem at the moment is that people don't trust those who deliver the energy efficiency in the home. You don't trust the double glazing salesman. If you try to buy, I mean, I have just changed all our heating so that we have air source heat pumps. I mean, I have had the fortune of spending a lot of my time dealing with this through the Climate Change Committee, so I do know a bit about it. I mean, if you don't know about it, it is absolutely impossible and really difficult. And the industry is very bad at both at selling itself and also of ensuring that the people you have to install these things are capable of doing it. And that capability element is the thing that we've got to get right. Because if you install an air source heat pump or a ground source heat pump badly, it's actually a disaster. And so you really have to get that right. And I think there are many people who are more likely to get this thing right than the government itself, or indeed American logistics groups who really don't seem to have understood how you do it.
Mm-hmm. So just touch on there as well, because you talked around ground heat pumps and things. What type of technology, you know, should we be looking at to decarbonize homes? And does this differ between old and new dwellings? You talked around heat pumps there. Is there anything else that you kind of look at?
I think it's horses for courses. I mean, there will be some places where in urban areas, it seems to me that heating, combined heating systems is what you will have. And they are now very, very customer friendly. People are afraid of them because it used to be true that you had the heat which the council decided you were going to have. And it's very important that you have a system. It needs two things. One is that you have the right and you make the choices. But the other bit that is terribly important is that you benefit if you turn it off or turn it down. And some of the systems, I have one of my staff was really moaning at me the other day because he said, I've got one of these systems. It ought to be extremely good because after all, this is environmentally friendly. He said, but the trouble is we have a standard bill. So I may not use the heating. In fact, I don't very much, but I pay the same bill as the person next door who's got it on all the time. So you have to have that. That's true in Whitehall, by the way. Do you know that when I was trying to do something about this in Whitehall, as far as ministers can, when I was a minister, this is 20 years ago, the fact was you couldn't get ministries to do anything about it because they all paid the same amount anyway, and there was no way of telling what they were using. So you couldn't actually get it to work. So I think that's very important. And I think in urban areas, we're going to have a lot more of that. Why not? It's exactly how we should do it. In new build, they're going to have to find ways to provide heating off the away from fossil fuels, because that's what the Future Homes Target, Future Homes legislation will say for 2025. I mean, it ought to be much earlier, but it's 2025. So at least that's what they'll have to do. So they'll have to do that. And then I think where we have hydrogen hubs, where it'll be necessary to have for industry, and we're having to have a hydrogen system, it may well be that we'll be able to use hydrogen in those areas. I think it's probably true that we won't be I would be enormously surprised, let me put it this way, I'd be enormously surprised that we found a way in which you put hydrogen into the gas pipes. I just don't think that is what's going to happen. But I can imagine places where you did do that because you had other reasons for creating the hydrogen. You might have too much, in a general term, too much wind power to use all the time, and you could use that therefore to make what would be therefore economically very cheap hydrogen, which is what Veolia, for example, is doing in Germany at the moment. So there may be things that you do like that, but they'll give you centers, they will give you hubs, so there'll be some places where that works, but elsewhere it's going to be heat pumps. That's what's going to make the difference, heat pumps and proper insulation. And the difficulty is the older house where you can't have underfloor heating and where the insulation is much more difficult. I've got that in this house. It's a listed building. I can't do a lot of things with it, but it's surprising what you can do. And then there will be ways in which you deal with that. So you will change from the gas to, instead of having canna gas, you'll have canna gas, which is biogas. So you will move to, and it'll be a whole collection of different things. Again, it's never either or, it's always both and that's what we will be doing.
Lovely, thank you. I guess my closing question for you today, Lord Deben, is just around, we talked around central government, but how does the role of local government differ here? Can they support something in this smart home of the future? What areas do they need to consider to accelerate the adoption of smarter homes moving forward?
Well, I mean, I think local and regional government, absolutely key to all this. And when you say what could they do, I think the first thing is the government has got to give them the powers to do these things. And again, I would be radical about this. I really do think that, for example, on the planning system, I would be saying government should be setting the minimum standards, but it should free local authorities to make tougher standards. So if you are a local authority that really wants to get on with this, you would be able to impose upon developers higher standards. So let's take a city like Cambridge. The advantages of developing in Cambridge are enormous, huge, vastly better than let us say, doing it in Barnsley. So Cambridge ought to be allowed to say, well, if you're going to develop in our area, then the standards to which you develop are going to be different. So we are going to demand standards of a different kind because that's what we want to do. So I want to free local authorities to raise standards. They would not be able to lower them, but they would be able to raise them. Now, this is terribly, this is anathema to civil servants at the centre because they really do feel that they know best and they should be doing this. I think it's true. I think that's what we've got to devolve much more effectively than we do at the moment. We've got to also recognise that the only people who can really deliver the sort of energy efficiency are the local authorities, because you have to do that street by street. I mean, that's the best way to do it. So imagine the local authority would do it street by street and people would opt into it. It's the local people know the local areas, know how you do it, know the mechanisms. And it's just because there is a central government view that somehow or other local authorities are incapable. They're only incapable, but they haven't been given the power or the money. You've got to give both of those, and you've got to devolve both of those. And it's particularly true with the combined authorities, like the West Midland Combined Authority. It really could do a huge amount more if it had the powers to do that. And so I see local authorities, regional authorities being hugely important, very good for levelling up, exactly what you need to do in a country which is far too dependent upon London. And of course, it's the moment to do it, because what we're doing now in your podcast we wouldn't have done before COVID. What we've learned to do is to use this. And all those boring grandparents who used to say, oh, I can't deal with this, I have to ask my five-year-old grandson to turn the television on, all those people have now learned to do it very easily because they can't talk to their five-year-old grandchild unless they can. So they've all learned it. And that kind of awful British middle-class concept that somehow or other it's not decent to know about technology has changed. So it's a wonderful moment for us to do it.
So I'm going to ask you, I know that was, I said that was my final question. My final question to you, just to finish the podcast today, is around COP26. Are you excited by COP26? What are you anticipating the output being from that?
Well, I'm excited by it. It's our last chance to get this right. I'm excited that the British should be leading in it. I am not excited by the fact that we haven't got anywhere near where we need to be yet. The world is a better place than it was when Mr. Trump was in charge in the United States. That was a world-changing moment. If ever there were something which we could celebrate, it is the election of Joe Biden. But the appalling thing is that 75 million people voted for that dreadful President Trump. How they managed to do that seems to me to be amazing. But still, there we are. We've now got a United States which is to rejoin the world, and therefore we have a real chance of winning this battle. I do think the government's got to work harder at it. I think there's got to be a lot more work done. But if we really put our backs into it, I think we can make a success of it. But it's not easy, and it's not something that will just appear. And sometimes I think that there's a feeling among those concerned that it will all turn out all right. It won't turn out all right unless we work a great deal harder than we are at the moment.
Oh, lovely. It was everything I anticipated it to be. What a wonderful conversation we've had. It's been a pleasure to listen to you today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time today, Lord Deben. A fascinating insight into how industry is leading the transition to a greener economy and the challenges we are embracing during the drive to net zero. As a reminder, in the run-up to COP26 in November 2021, we are launching the podcast series, The Drive to Net Zero. In each instance, we'll be speaking to notable experts from across the energy sector, discussing the very latest in legislation and thought leadership whilst we explore all areas of decarbonising the economy and infrastructure, and we'd love you to join us on that journey. So we look forward to seeing you on the next digital adventure, smart buildings of the future, and the role of e-mobility playing the sector. Goodbye for now.